His violin? Here? What about your violin? He was gasping.
I'm afraid they'll break my violin. I brought it with me.
I could not answer him. Someone had lain down on top of me, smothering me. I couldn't breathe through my mouth or my nose. Sweat was running down my forehead and my back. This was it, the end of the road, a silent death, suffocation. No way to scream, to call for help. I tried to rid myself of my invisible assassin. My whole desire to live became concentrated in my nails. I scratched. I fought for a breath of air. I tore at decaying flesh that did not respond. I couldn't free myself of that mass weighing down my chest. Who knows? Was I struggling with a dead man? I shall never know. All I can say is that I prevailed. I succeeded in digging a hole in that wall of dead and dying people. A small hole through which I could drink a little air. "Father, are you there?" I asked as soon as I was able to utter a word. I knew that he could not be far from me.
"Yes," a voice replied from far away, as if from another world. "I'm trying to sleep."
He was trying to sleep. Could one fall asleep here? Wasn't it dangerous to lower one's guard even for a moment when death could strike at any time? Those were my thoughts when I heard the sound of a violin. A violin in a dark barrack where the dead were piled on top of the living. Who was this madman who played the violin here at the edge of his own grave? Or was it a hallucination? It had to be Ulyak. He was playing a fragment of a Beethoven concerto. Never before had I heard such a beautiful sound in such silence. How had he succeeded in disengaging himself, to slip out from under my body without my feeling it? The darkness enveloped us. All I could hear was the violin. And it was as if Yuliak's soul had become his bow. He was playing his life. His whole being was gliding over the strings. His unfulfilled hopes, his charred past, his extinguished future. He played that which he would never play again. I shall never forget Yuliak. How could I forget this concert given before an audience of the dead and dying? Even today when I hear that particular piece by Beethoven, my eyes close and out of the darkness emerges the pale and melancholy face of my Polish comrade bidding farewell to an audience of dying men. I don't know how long he played. I was overcome by sleep. When I awoke at daybreak, I saw Ulyak facing me, hunched over, dead. Next to him lay his violin, trampled, an eerily poignant little corpse. We stayed in Gliwice for 3 days. Days without food or water. We were forbidden to leave the barrack. The door was guarded by the SS. I was hungry and thirsty. I must have been very dirty and disheveled to judge by what the others looked like. The bread we had brought from Buna had been devoured long since, and who knew when we would be given another ration. The front followed us. We again could hear the cannons very close by, but we no longer had the strength or the courage to think that the Germans would run out of time, that the Russians would reach us before we could be evacuated. We learned that we would be moved to the center of Germany. On the third day at dawn, we were driven out of the barrack. We threw blankets over our shoulders, like prayer shawls. We were directed to a gate that divided the camp in two. A group of SS officers stood waiting. A word flew through our ranks, selection. The SS officers were doing the selection, the weak to the left, those who walked well to the right. My father was sent to the left. I ran after him. An SS officer shouted at my back, "Come back!" I inched my way through the crowd.
Several SS men rushed to find me, creating such confusion that a number of people were able to switch over to the right, among them my father and I. Still, there were gunshots and some dead. We were led out of the camp. After a half-hour march, we arrived in the very middle of a field crossed by railroad tracks. This was where we were to wait for the train's arrival. Snow was falling heavily. We were forbidden to sit down or to move. A thick layer of snow was accumulating on our blankets. We were given bread, the usual ration. We threw ourselves on it. Someone had the idea of quenching his thirst by eating snow. Soon, we were all imitating him. As we were not permitted to bend down, we took out our spoons and ate the snow off our neighbors' backs. A mouthful of bread and a spoonful of snow. The SS men who were watching were greatly amused by the spectacle. The hours went by. Our eyes were tired from staring at the horizon, waiting for the liberating train to appear. It arrived only very late that evening. An infinitely long train composed of roofless cattle cars. The SS shoved us inside, 100 per car. We were so skinny. When everybody was on board, the convoy left. Pressed tightly against one another, in an effort to resist the cold, our heads empty and heavy, our brains a whirlwind of decaying memories, our minds numb with indifference. Here or elsewhere, what did it matter? Die today or tomorrow or later? The night was growing longer, never ending. When at last a grayish light appeared on the horizon, it revealed a tangle of human shapes, heads sunk deeply between the shoulders, crouching, piled one on top of the other, like a cemetery covered with snow. In the early dawn light, I tried to distinguish between the living and those who were no more, but there was barely a difference. My gaze remained fixed on someone who, eyes wide open, stared into space. His colorless face was covered with a layer of frost and snow. My father had huddled near me, draped in his blanket, shoulders laden with snow. And what if he were dead as well? I called out to him, no response. I would have screamed if I could have. He was not moving. Suddenly, the evidence overwhelmed me. There was no longer any reason to live, any reason to fight. The train stopped in an empty field. The abrupt halt had wakened a few sleepers. They stood, looking around, startled. Outside, the SS walked by, shouting, "Throw out all the dead! Outside, all the corpses!" The living were glad. They would have more room. Volunteers began the task. They touched those who had remained on the ground. "Here's one. Take him." The volunteers undressed him and eagerly shared his garments. Then two grave diggers grabbed him by the head and feet and threw him from the wagon like a sack of flour. There was shouting all around. "Come on, here's another, my neighbor, he's not moving." I woke from my apathy only when two men approached my father. I threw myself on his body. He was cold. I slapped him. I rubbed his hands, crying, "Father, father, wake up. They're going to throw you outside." His body remained inert. The two gravediggers had grabbed me by the neck. "Leave him alone. Can't you see that he's dead?" "No," I yelled. "He's not dead. Not yet." And I started to hit him harder and harder. At last, my father half opened his eyes. They were glassy. He was breathing faintly. "You see?" I cried. The two men went away. 20 corpses were thrown from our wagon. Then the train resumed its journey, leaving in its wake, in a snowy field in Poland, hundreds of naked orphans without a tomb. We received no food. We lived on snow. It took the place of bread. The days resembled the nights, and the nights left in our souls the dregs of their darkness. The train rolled slowly, often halted for a few hours, and continued. It never stopped snowing. We remained lying on the floor for days and nights, one on top of the other, never uttering a word. We were nothing but frozen bodies. Our eyes closed. We merely waited for the next stop to unload our dead. There followed days and nights of traveling. Occasionally, we would pass through German towns. Usually, very early in the morning, German labourers were going to work. They would stop and look at us without surprise. One day when we had come to a stop, a worker took a piece of bread out of his bag and threw it into a wagon. There was a stampede. Dozens of starving men fought desperately over a few crumbs. The worker watched the spectacle with great interest. Years later, I witnessed a similar spectacle in Aden. Our ship's passengers amused themselves by throwing coins to the natives who dove to retrieve them. An elegant Parisian lady took great pleasure in this game. When I noticed two children desperately fighting in the water, one trying to strangle the other, I implored the lady, "Please don't throw any more coins." "Why not?" said she. "I like to give charity." In the wagon where the bread had landed, a battle had ensued. Men were hurling themselves against each other, trampling, tearing at, and mauling each other. Beasts of prey unleashed animal hate in their eyes. An extraordinary vitality possessed them, sharpening their teeth and nails. A crowd of workmen and curious passers-by had formed all along the train. They had undoubtedly never seen a train with this kind of cargo. Soon, pieces of bread were falling into the wagons from all sides, and the spectators observed these emaciated creatures ready to kill for a crust of bread. A piece fell into our wagon. I decided not to move. Anyway, I knew that I would not be strong enough to fight off dozens of violent men. I saw, not far from me, an old man dragging himself on all fours. He had just detached himself from the struggling mob. He was holding one hand to his heart. At first, I thought he had received a blow to his chest. Then I understood. He was hiding a piece of bread under his shirt. With lightning speed, he pulled it out and put it to his mouth. His eyes lit up, a smile, like a grimace, illuminated his ashen face, and was immediately extinguished. A shadow had lain down beside him, and this shadow threw itself over him. Stunned by the blows, the old man was crying, "Mayor, my little mayor, don't you recognize me? You're killing your father. I have bread for you too, for you too." He collapsed, but his fist was still clutching a small crust. He wanted to raise it to his mouth, but the other threw himself on him. The old man mumbled something, groaned, and died. Nobody cared. His son searched him, took the crust of bread, and began to devour it. He didn't get far. Two men had been watching him. They jumped him. Others joined in. When they withdrew, there were two dead bodies next to me, the father and the son. I was 16. In our wagon, there was a friend of my father's, Mayor Katz. He had worked as a gardener in Buna, and from time to time had brought us some green vegetables. Less undernourished than the rest of us, detention had been easier on him. Because he was stronger than most of us, he had been put in charge of our wagon. On the third night of our journey, I woke up with a start when I felt two hands on my throat trying to strangle me. I barely had time to call out, "Father!" Just that one word. I was suffocating. But my father had awakened and grabbed my aggressor. Too weak to overwhelm him, he thought of calling Mayor Katz. "Come, come quickly. Someone is strangling my son." In a few moments, I was freed. I never did find out why the stranger had wanted to strangle me. But days later, Mayor Katz told my father, "Shlomo, I am getting weak. My strength is gone. I won't make it." "Don't give in," my father tried to encourage him. "You must resist. Don't lose faith in yourself." But Mayor Katz only groaned in response. "I can't go on, Shlomo. I can't help it. I can't go on." My father took his arm, and Mayor Katz, the strong one, the sturdiest of us all, began to cry. His son had been taken from him during the first selection, but only now was he crying for him. Only now did he fall apart. He could not go on. he had reached the end. On the last day of our journey, a terrible wind began to blow, and the snow kept falling. We sensed that the end was near, the real end. We could not hold out long in this glacial wind, this storm. Somebody got up and yelled, "We must not remain sitting. We shall freeze to death. Let's get up and move." We all got up. We all pulled our soaked blankets tighter around our shoulders, and we tried to take a few steps to shuffle back and forth in place. Suddenly, a cry rose in the wagon, the cry of a wounded animal. Someone had just died. Others, close to death, imitated his cry, and their cries seemed to come from beyond the grave. Soon, everybody was crying, groaning, moaning, cries of distress hurled into the wind and the snow. The lament spread from wagon to wagon. It was contagious. And now hundreds of cries rose at once, the death rattle of an entire convoy with the end approaching. All boundaries had been crossed. Nobody had any strength left, and the night seemed endless. Mayor Katz was moaning, "Why don't they just shoot us now?" That same night, we reached our destination. It was late. The guards came to unload us. The dead were left in the wagons. Only those who could stand could leave. Mayor Katz remained on the train. The last day had been the most lethal. We had been 100 or so in this wagon. 12 of us left it. Among them, my father and myself. We had arrived in Buchenwald.
This ends Disc 3. Night. Disc 4.
At the entrance to the camp, SS officers were waiting for us. We were counted. Then we were directed to the Appelplatz. The orders were given over the loudspeakers. Form ranks of fives, groups of 100, 5 steps forward. I tightened my grip on my father's hand, the old familiar fear not to lose him. Very close to us stood the tall chimney of the crematorium's furnace. It no longer impressed us. It barely drew our attention. A veteran of Buchenwald told us that we would be taking a shower and afterward be sent to different blocks. The idea of a hot shower fascinated me. My father didn't say a word. He was breathing heavily beside me. "Father," I said, "just another moment. Soon we'll be able to lie down. You'll be able to rest." He didn't answer. I myself was so weary that his silence left me indifferent. My only wish was to take the shower as soon as possible and lie down on a cot. Only it wasn't easy to reach the showers. Hundreds of prisoners crowded the area. The guards seemed unable to restore order. They were lashing out left and right to no avail. Some prisoners who didn't have the strength to jostle or even to stand sat down in the snow. My father wanted to do the same. He was moaning, "I can't anymore. It's over. I shall die right here." He dragged me toward a pile of snow from which protruded human shapes, torn blankets. "Leave me," he said. "I can't go on anymore. Have pity on me. I'll wait here until we can go into the showers. You'll come and get me." I could have screamed in anger. To have lived and endured so much, was I going to let my father die now? Now that we would be able to take a good hot shower and lie down? "Father," I howled, "father, get up right now. You will kill yourself." And I grabbed his arm. He continued to moan. "Don't yell, my son. Have pity on your old father. Let me rest here a little. I beg of you. I'm so tired. No more strength." He had become childlike, weak, frightened, vulnerable. "Father," I said, "you cannot stay here." I pointed to the corpses around him. They too had wanted to rest here.
I see, my son, I do see them. Let them sleep. They haven't closed an eye for so long. They're exhausted. Exhausted.
His voice was tender. I howled into the wind.
They're dead. They will never wake up. Never. Do you understand?
This discussion continued for some time. I knew that I was no longer arguing with him, but with death itself. With death that he had already chosen. The sirens began to wail. Alert. The lights went out in the entire camp. The guards chased us toward the blocks. In a flash, there was no one left outside. We were only too glad not to have to stay outside any longer in the freezing wind. We let ourselves sink into the floor. The cauldrons at the entrance found no takers. There were several tiers of bunks. To sleep was all that mattered. When I woke up, it was daylight. That is when I remembered that I had a father. During the alert, I had followed the mob, not taking care of him. I knew he was running out of strength, close to death, and yet I had abandoned him. I went to look for him. Yet at the same time, a thought crept into my mind. If only I didn't find him. If only I were relieved of this responsibility, I could use all my strength to fight for my own survival, to take care only of myself. Instantly, I felt ashamed. Ashamed of myself. Forever. I walked for hours without finding him. Then I came to a block where they were distributing black coffee. People stood in line, quarreled. A plaintive voice came from behind me. Eliezer, my son, bring me a little coffee. I ran toward him. Father, I've been looking for you for so long. Where were you? Did you sleep? How are you feeling? He seemed to be burning with fever. I fought my way to the coffee cauldron like a wild beast, and I succeeded in bringing back a cup. I took one gulp. The rest was for him. I shall never forget the gratitude that shone in his eyes when he swallowed this beverage. The gratitude of a wounded animal. With these few mouthfuls of hot water, I had probably given him more satisfaction than during my entire childhood. He was lying on the boards, ashen, his lips pale and dry, shivering. I couldn't stay with him any longer. We had been ordered to go outside to allow for cleaning of the blocks. Only the sick could remain inside. We stayed outside for 5 hours. We were given soup. When they allowed us to return to the blocks, I rushed toward my father. Did you eat? No. Why? They didn't give us anything. They said that we were sick, that we would die soon, and that it would be a waste of food. I can't go on. I gave him what was left of my soup. But my heart was heavy. I was aware that I was doing it grudgingly. Just like Rabbi Eliyahu's son, I had not passed the test. Every day my father was getting weaker. His eyes were watery, his face the color of dead leaves. On the third day after we arrived in Buchenwald, everybody had to go to the showers, even the sick who were instructed to go last. When we returned from the showers, we had to wait outside a long time. The cleaning of the blocks had not been completed. From afar, I saw my father and ran to meet him. He went by me like a shadow, passing me without stopping, without a glance. I called to him. He did not turn around. I ran after him. Father, where are you running? He looked at me for a moment, and his gaze was distant, otherworldly. The face of a stranger. It lasted only a moment, and then he ran away. Suffering from dysentery, my father was prostrate on his cot with another 5 sick inmates nearby. I sat next to him, watching him. I no longer dared to believe that he could still elude death. I did all I could to give him hope. All of a sudden, he sat up and placed his feverish lips against my ear.
"Eliezer, I must tell you where I buried the gold and silver. In the cellar, you know?"
And he began talking, faster and faster, afraid of running out of time before he could tell me everything. I tried to tell him that it was not over yet, that we would be going home together. But he no longer wanted to listen to me. He could no longer listen to me. He was worn out. Saliva mixed with blood was trickling from his lips. He had closed his eyes. He was gasping more than breathing. For a ration of bread, I was able to exchange cots to be next to my father. When the doctor arrived in the afternoon, I went to tell him that my father was very ill. "Bring him here." I explained that he could not stand up, but the doctor would not listen, and so, with great difficulty, I brought my father to him. He stared at him, then asked curtly, "What do you want?" "My father is sick," I answered in his place. "Dysentery."
"That's not my business. I'm a surgeon. Go on. Make room for the others."
My protests were in vain.
"I can't go on, my son. Take me back to my bunk."
I took him back and helped him lie down. He was shivering.
"Try to get some sleep, father. Try to fall asleep."
His breathing was labored. His eyes were closed. But I was convinced that he was seeing everything, that he was seeing the truth in all things. Another doctor came to the block. My father refused to get up. He knew that it would be of no use. In fact, that doctor had come only to finish off the patients. I listened to him shouting at them that they were lazy, good-for-nothings who only wanted to stay in bed. I considered jumping him, strangling him. But I had neither the courage nor the strength. I was riveted to my father's agony. My hands were aching. I was clenching them so hard to strangle the doctor and the others, to set the whole world on fire. My father's murderers. But even the cry stuck in my throat. On my return from the bread distribution, I found my father crying like a child.
"My son, they are beating me."
"Who?" I thought he was delirious.
"Him, the Frenchman, and the Pole. They beat me."
One more stab to the heart. One more reason to hate. One less reason to live.
"Eliezer, Eliezer, tell them not to beat me. I haven't done anything. Why are they beating me?"
I began to insult his neighbors. They mocked me. I promised them bread, soup. They laughed. Then they got angry. They could not stand my father any longer, they said, because he no longer was able to drag himself outside to relieve himself. The following day, he complained that they had taken his ration of bread. "While you were asleep?"
"No, I wasn't asleep. They threw themselves on me. They snatched it from me, my bread. And they beat me again. I can't go on, my son. Give me some water."
I knew that he must not drink, but he pleaded with me so long that I gave in. Water was the worst poison for him, but what else could I do for him? With or without water, it would be over soon anyway.
"You, at least, have pity on me."
Have pity on him?
I, his only son.
A week went by like that. "Is this your father?" asked the block eltiste. "Yes. He is very sick. The doctor won't do anything for him." He looked me straight in the eye. "The doctor cannot do anything more for him, and neither can you." He placed his big hairy hand on my shoulder and added, "Listen to me, kid. Don't forget that you are in a concentration camp. In this place, it is every man for himself, and you cannot think of others, not even your father. In this place, there is no such thing as father, brother, friend. Each of us lives and dies alone. Let me give you good advice. Stop giving your ration of bread and soup to your old father. You cannot help him anymore. And you're hurting yourself. In fact, you should be getting his rations." I listened to him without interrupting. He was right, I thought, deep down, not daring to admit it to myself. Too late to save your old father. You could have 2 rations of bread, 2 rations of soup. It was only a fraction of a second, but it left me feeling guilty. I ran to get some soup and brought it to my father. But he didn't want it. All he wanted was water. "Don't drink water. Eat the soup. I'm burning up. Why are you so mean to me, my son? Water." I brought him water. Then I left the block for roll call. But I quickly turned back. I lay down on the upper bunk. The sick were allowed to stay in the block, so I would be sick. I didn't want to leave my father. All around me there was silence now, broken only by moaning. In front of the block, the SS were giving orders. An officer passed between the bunks. My father was pleading, "My son, water. I'm burning up. My insides." "Silence over there," barked the officer.
"Eliezer," continued my father, "water."
The officer came closer and shouted to him to be silent. But my father did not hear. He continued to call me. The officer wielded his club and dealt him a violent blow to the head. I didn't move. I was afraid. My body was afraid of another blow, this time to my head. My father groaned once more. I heard, "Eliezer." I could see that he was still breathing in gasps. I didn't move. When I came down from my bunk after roll call, I could see his lips trembling. He was murmuring something. I remained more than an hour leaning over him, looking at him, etching his bloody, broken face into my mind. Then I had to go to sleep. I climbed into my bunk above my father, who was still alive. The date was January 28th, 1945. I woke up at dawn on January 29th. On my father's cot, there lay another sick person. They must have taken him away before daybreak and taken him to the crematorium. Perhaps he was still breathing. No prayers were said over his tomb. No candle lit in his memory. His last word had been my name. He had called out to me, and I had not answered. I did not weep, and it pained me that I could not weep. But I was out of tears, and deep inside me, if I could have searched the recesses of my feeble conscience, I might have found something like free at last. I remained in Buchenwald until April 11th. I shall not describe my life during that period. It no longer mattered. Since my father's death, nothing mattered to me anymore. I was transferred to the children's block where there were 600 of us. The front was coming closer. I spent my days in total idleness, with only one desire, to eat. I no longer thought of my father or my mother. From time to time, I would dream, but only about soup, an extra ration of soup. On April 5th, the wheel of history turned. It was late afternoon. We were standing inside the block, waiting for an SS to come and count us. He was late. Such lateness was unprecedented in the history of Buchenwald. Something must have happened. 2 hours later, the loudspeakers transmitted an order from the camp commandant. All Jews were to gather in the upper plots. This was the end. Hitler was about to keep his promise. The children of our block did as ordered. There was no choice. Gustav, the Blockälteste, made it clear with his club. But on our way, we met some prisoners who whispered to us, "Go back to your block. The Germans plan to shoot you. Go back and don't move." We returned to the block. On our way there, we learned that the underground resistance of the camp had made the decision not to abandon the Jews and to prevent their liquidation. As it was getting late and the confusion was great, countless Jews had been passing as non-Jews. The Lagerälteste had decided that a general roll call would take place the next day. Everybody would have to be present. The roll call took place. The Lagerkommandant announced that the Buchenwald camp would be liquidated. 10 blocks of inmates would be evacuated every day. From that moment on, there was no further distribution of bread and soup. And the evacuation began. Every day, a few thousand inmates passed the camp's gate and did not return. On April 10th, there were still some 20,000 prisoners in the camp, among them a few hundred children. It was decided to evacuate all of us at once, by evening. Afterward, they would blow up the camp. And so we were herded onto the huge upper plots in ranks of 5, waiting for the gate to open. Suddenly, the sirens began to scream. Alert! We went back to the blocks. It was too late to evacuate us that evening. The evacuation was postponed to the next day. Hunger was tormenting us. We had not eaten for nearly 6 days, except for a few stalks of grass and some potato peels found on the grounds of the kitchens. At 10 o'clock in the morning, the SS took positions throughout the camp and began to herd the last of us toward the Appelplatz. The resistance movement decided at that point to act. Armed men appeared from everywhere, bursts of gunshots, grenades exploding. We, the children, remained flat on the floor of the block. The battle did not last long. Around noon, everything was calm again. The SS had fled, and the resistance had taken charge of the camp. At 6 o'clock that afternoon, the first American tank stood at the gates of Buchenwald. Our first act as free men was to throw ourselves onto the provisions. That's all we thought about. No thought of revenge or of parents, only of bread. And even when we were no longer hungry, not one of us thought of revenge. The next day, a few of the young men ran into Weimar to bring back some potatoes and clothes and to sleep with girls. But still, no trace of revenge. 3 days after the liberation of Buchenwald, I became very ill, some form of poisoning. I was transferred to a hospital and spent 2 weeks between life and death. One day, when I was able to get up, I decided to look at myself in the mirror on the opposite wall. I had not seen myself since the ghetto. From the depths of the mirror, a corpse was contemplating me. The look in his eyes as he gazed at me has never left me.
The end. You've been listening to Night by Elie Wiesel, translated from the French by Marion Wiesel, narrated by George Guidel. This recording was directed by Natanya Johnson. This new edition of Night concludes with Elie Wiesel's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, read here by George Guidel.
Your Majesty, Your Royal Highnesses, Your Excellencies, Chairman Arvik, members of the Nobel Committee, ladies and gentlemen. Words of gratitude. First to our common Creator. This is what the Jewish tradition commands us to do. At special occasions, one is duty-bound to recite the following prayer. Baruch ata Adonai, shehechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'higiyanu lazman hazeh. Blessed be thou, for giving us life, for sustaining us, and for enabling us to reach this day. Then, thank you, Chairman Arvik, for the depth of your eloquence, and for the generosity of your gesture. Thank you for building bridges between people and generations. Thank you, above all, for helping humankind make peace its most urgent and noble aspiration. I am moved, deeply moved, by your words, Chairman Arvik. And it is with a profound sense of humility that I accept the honor, the highest there is, that you have chosen to bestow upon me. I know your choice transcends my person. Do I have the right to represent the multitudes who have perished? Do I have the right to accept this great honor on their behalf? I do not. No one may speak for the dead. No one may interpret their mutilated dreams and visions. And yet I sense their presence. I always do. And at this moment more than ever. The presence of my parents, that of my little sister. The presence of my teachers, my friends, my companions. This honor belongs to all the survivors and their children, and through us, to the Jewish people with whose destiny I have always identified. I remember. It happened yesterday, or eternities ago. A young Jewish boy discovered the kingdom of night. I remember his bewilderment. I remember his anguish. It all happened so fast. The ghetto, the deportation, the sealed cattle car, the fiery altar upon which the history of our people and the future of mankind were meant to be sacrificed. I remember he asked his father, "Can this be true? This is the 20th century, not the Middle Ages. Who would allow such crimes to be committed? How could the world remain silent?" And now the boy is turning to me. "Tell me," he asks, "what have you done with my future? What have you done with your life?" And I tell him that I have tried. That I have tried to keep memory alive. That I have tried to fight those who would forget. Because if we forget, we are guilty, we are accomplices. And then I explain to him how naive we were, that the world did know and remained silent. And that is why I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Sometimes we must interfere. When human lives are endangered, when human dignity is in jeopardy, national borders and sensitivities become irrelevant. Wherever men and women are persecuted because of their race, religion, or political views, that place must, at that moment, become the center of the universe. Of course, since I am a Jew profoundly rooted in my people's memory and tradition, my first response is to Jewish fears, Jewish needs, Jewish crises. For I belong to a traumatized generation, one that experienced the abandonment and solitude of our people. It would be unnatural for me not to make Jewish priorities my own. Israel, Soviet Jewry, Jews in Arab lands. But others are important to me. Apartheid is, in my view, as abhorrent as anti-Semitism. To me, Andrei Sakharov's isolation is as much a disgrace as Joseph Begun's imprisonment and Ida Nudel's exile, as is the denial of solidarity and its leader Lech Wałęsa's right to dissent, and Nelson Mandela's interminable imprisonment. There is so much injustice and suffering crying out for our attention. Victims of hunger, of racism and political persecution, in Chile, for instance, or in Ethiopia. Writers and poets, prisoners in so many lands governed by the left and by the right. Human rights are being violated on every continent. More people are oppressed than free. How can one not be sensitive to their plight? Human suffering anywhere concerns men and women everywhere. That applies also to Palestinians, to whose plight I am sensitive, but whose methods I deplore when they lead to violence. Violence is not the answer. Terrorism is the most dangerous of answers. They are frustrated. That is understandable. Something must be done. The refugees and their misery. The children and their fear. The uprooted and their hopelessness. Something must be done about their situation. Both the Jewish people and the Palestinian people have lost too many sons and daughters and have shed too much blood. This must stop, and all attempts to stop it must be encouraged. Israel will cooperate, I am sure of that. I trust Israel, for I have faith in the Jewish people. Let Israel be given a chance. Let hatred and danger be removed from their horizons, and there will be peace in and around the Holy Land. Please understand my deep and total commitment to Israel. If you could remember what I remember, you would understand. Israel is the only nation in the world whose existence is threatened. Should Israel lose but one war, it would mean her end and ours as well. But I have faith. Faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and even in his creation. Without it, no action would be possible. And action is the only remedy to indifference, the most insidious danger of all. Isn't that the meaning of Alfred Nobel's legacy? Wasn't his fear of war a shield against war? There is so much to be done. There is so much that can be done. One person, a Raoul Wallenberg, an Albert Schweitzer, a Martin Luther King Jr., one person of integrity can make a difference of life and death. As long as one dissident is in prison, our freedom will not be true. As long as one child is hungry, our life will be filled with anguish and shame. What all these victims need above all is to know that they are not alone, that we are not forgetting them, that when their voices are stifled, we shall lend them ours, that while their freedom depends on ours, the quality of our freedom depends on theirs. This is what I say to the young Jewish boy wondering what I have done with his years. It is in his name that I speak to you and that I express to you my deepest gratitude as one who has emerged from the kingdom of night. We know that every moment is a moment of grace, every hour an offering. Not to share them would mean to betray them. Our lives no longer belong to us alone. They belong to all those who need us desperately. Thank you, Chairman Arvik. Thank you, members of the Nobel Committee. Thank you, people of Norway, for declaring on this singular occasion that our survival has meaning for mankind.
That was Elie Wiesel's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech, given in Oslo on December 10th, 1986.
Could men and women who consider it normal to assist the weak, to heal the sick, to protect small children, and to respect the wisdom of their elders understand what happened there? Would they be able to comprehend how, within that cursed universe, the masters tortured the weak and massacred the children, the sick and the old? And yet, having lived through this experience, one could not keep silent, no matter how difficult, if not impossible, it was to speak. And so I persevered, and trusted the silence that envelops and transcends words. Knowing all the while
that any one of the fields of ashes in Birkenau carry more weight than all the testimonies about Birkenau. For despite all my attempts to articulate the unspeakable, it is still not right. Is that why my manuscript, written in Yiddish as "And the World Remained Silent," and translated first into French, then into English, was rejected by every major publisher, French and American, despite the tireless efforts of the great Catholic French writer and Nobel laureate François Mauriac? After months and months of personal visits, letters and telephone calls, he finally succeeded in getting it into print. Though I made numerous cuts, the original Yiddish version still was long. Jérôme Landon, the legendary head of the small but prestigious Édition de Minuit, edited and further cut the French version. I accepted his decision because I worried that some things might be superfluous. Substance alone mattered. I was more afraid of having said too much than too little. Example: in the Yiddish version, the narrative opens with these cynical musings. In the beginning, there was faith, which is childish, trust, which is vain, and illusion, which is dangerous. We believed in God, trusted in man, and lived with the illusion that every one of us has been entrusted with a sacred spark from the Shekhinah's flame, that every one of us carries in his eyes and in his soul a reflection of God's image. That was the source, if not the cause, of all our ordeals.
Upon the publication of this new translation, Elie Wiesel wrote the following preface to the print edition.
If in my lifetime I was to write only one book, this would be the one. Just as the past lingers in the present, all my writings after night, including those that deal with biblical, Talmudic, or Hasidic themes, profoundly bear its stamp, and cannot be understood if one has not read this very first of my works. Why did I write it? Did I write it so as not to go mad, or, on the contrary, to go mad in order to understand the nature of madness, the immense, terrifying madness that had erupted in history and in the conscience of mankind? Was it to leave behind a legacy of words, of memories, to help prevent history from repeating itself? Or was it simply to preserve a record of the ordeal I endured as an adolescent, at an age when one's knowledge of death and evil should be limited to what one discovers in literature? There are those who tell me that I survived in order to write this text. I am not convinced. I don't know how I survived. I was weak, rather shy. I did nothing to save myself. A miracle? Certainly not. If heaven could or would perform a miracle for me, why not for others more deserving than myself? It was nothing more than chance. However, having survived, I needed to give some meaning to my survival. Was it to protect that meaning that I set to paper an experience in which nothing made any sense? In retrospect, I must confess that I do not know, or no longer know, what I wanted to achieve with my words. I only know that without this testimony, my life as a writer, or my life period, would not have become what it is, that of a witness who believes he has a moral obligation to try to prevent the enemy from enjoying one last victory by allowing his crimes to be erased from human memory. For today, thanks to recently discovered documents, the evidence shows that in the early days of their accession to power, the Nazis in Germany set out to build a society in which there simply would be no room for Jews. Toward the end of their reign, their goal changed. They decided to leave behind a world in ruins in which Jews would seem never to have existed. That is why everywhere in Russia, in the Ukraine and in Lithuania, the Einsatzgruppen carried out the final solution by turning their machine guns on more than 1 million Jews, men, women, and children.
and throwing them into huge mass graves, dug just moments before by the victims themselves. Special units would then disinter the corpses and burn them. Thus, for the first time in history, Jews were not only killed twice, but denied burial in a cemetery. It is obvious that the war which Hitler and his accomplices waged was a war not only against Jewish men, women, and children, but also against Jewish religion, Jewish culture, Jewish tradition, therefore Jewish memory. Convinced that this period in history would be judged one day, I knew that I must bear witness. I also knew that while I had many things to say, I did not have the words to say them. Painfully aware of my limitations, I watched helplessly as language became an obstacle. It became clear that it would be necessary to invent a new language. But how was one to rehabilitate and transform words betrayed and perverted by the enemy? Hunger, thirst, fear, transport, selection, fire, chimney. These words all have intrinsic meaning, but in those times, they meant something else. Writing in my mother tongue, at that point close to extinction, I would pause at every sentence and start over and over again. I would conjure up other verbs, other images, other silent cries. It still was not right. But what exactly was it? It was something elusive, darkly shrouded for fear of being usurped, profaned. All the dictionary had to offer seemed meager, pale, lifeless. Was there a way to describe the last journey in sealed cattle cars, the last voyage toward the unknown? Or the discovery of a demented and glacial universe where to be inhuman was human? Where disciplined, educated men in uniform came to kill, and innocent children and weary old men came to die? Or the countless separations on a single fiery night, the tearing apart of entire families, entire communities? Or, incredibly, the vanishing of a beautiful, well-behaved little Jewish girl with golden hair and a sad smile, murdered with her mother the very night of their arrival? How was one to speak of them without trembling and a heart broken for all eternity? Deep down, the witness knew then, as he does now, that his testimony would not be received. After all, it deals with an event that sprang from the darkest zone of man. Only those who experienced Auschwitz know what it was. Others will never know. But would they at least understand? Other passages from the original Yiddish text had more on the death of my father and on the liberation. Why not include those in this new translation? Too personal, too private, perhaps. They need to remain between the lines. And yet, I remember that night, the most horrendous of my life. Eliezer, my son, come here. I want to tell you something, only to you. Come, don't leave me alone, Eliezer. I heard his voice, grasped the meaning of his words and the tragic dimension of the moment, yet I did not move. It had been his last wish to have me next to him in his agony at the moment when his soul was tearing itself from his lacerated body. Yet I did not let him have his wish. I was afraid, afraid of the blows. That was why I remained deaf to his cries. Instead of sacrificing my miserable life and rushing to his side, taking his hand, reassuring him, showing him that he was not abandoned, that I was near him, that I felt his sorrow, instead of all that, I remained flat on my back, asking God to make my father stop calling my name, to make him stop crying. So afraid was I to incur the wrath of the SS. In fact, my father was no longer conscious. Yet his plaintive, harrowing voice went on piercing the silence and calling me. Nobody but me. "Well," The SS had flown into a rage and was striking my father on the head. "Be quiet, old man, be quiet!" My father no longer felt the club's blows. I did. And yet I did not react. I let the SS